I'd like to start by thanking Ken and Chris for inviting me to be here this week. It's really, for me, it's been very enjoyable and stimulating. And I need to thank you also for allowing me to talk about type 1As on Wednesday, even though they may be outside the bounds of this workshop. Whether I should thank you for allowing me to give this talk today remains to be seen. But I also want to thank all of you who sat through my talk on Wednesday, and even so, you showed up again today. Thank you very much. As I explained on Wednesday, it was originally to be one talk, but then we decided to break it into two. So on Wednesday, I talked about type 1As, and we won't do that again. And today, well, of course, we need a little bit of repeat introduction, but not much. It'll go quickly. And then today, I'd like to talk about type 1Bs as a warm-up exercise. And you see what's on my mind. Ubiquitous hydrogen with a question mark. Do type 1Bs all or nearly all have hydrogen? And even in O5BF, and if you don't know who O5BF is, you'll find out. Actually, three people in the room, Ken, Paolo, Tommy, are quite familiar with O5PF. They've already published something. I have not. And then after the warm-up exercise, let's go to type 1Cs. And you see the question I'm raising. Could there be hydrogen in type 1Cs? And if all goes according to plan, then by the time I finish, we'll know less about type 1Cs than we do at this moment. I'm talking about spectroscopy, but I'm going to flash some photometry at you just to help me make a point. And the point is that when we look at 1Bs and 1Cs, I'm struck by how data-starved we are. If you're interested in the diversity, not just saying, oh, well, a 1B looks like that and a 1C looks like that, okay, we have enough to do that. But if you start to look at the diversity as we look at it in type 1As, we're really data-starved, not only spectroscopically, but also photometrically. So I'm going to show just a little bit of some photometric results. This is from a PhD thesis at Oklahoma by Dean Richardson. It's not even on AstroPH yet, unless it has appeared this week. I haven't checked. But what he did, among other things, is he tried to collect all the photometry of 1BCs that he could. Now, it's not quite up to date, because there was a gap between when he stopped and when it got accepted, which was recently. But if we want to plot absolute magnitude with some attempt to correct for extinction, absolute magnitude against distance modulus. So Virgo cluster distance is about 31 on this scale. So these are very nearby. Nothing is really high Z. And then this is what he could find. This is all he could find. 2Bs, well, there's three of them in black. And 1Bs, there's 11 of them in red. And notice the error bars are substantial. 1Cs, he found 13 of them in blue, I guess that is. And what can we say from data like this?
Type 2Bs as? What do you mean type 2Bs? What do you define them as?
2Bs like 93J, something that had obvious hydrogen lines at the beginning, but then they faded away and then they became like 1Bs with obvious helium lines. So what you can see, this, by the way, this line is a line of constant apparent magnitude, so that if you were searching to a near constant apparent magnitude, then you would populate this region to the left and not to the right, so that just to illustrate there's selection effects involved here. What else shall I say quickly? This is what we think of as the type 1A ridge line at minus 19.5, just for as a basis of comparison. So, okay, you can say that in a volume-limited sample in here to the left, well, sure, we know the characteristic absolute magnitudes are something like minus 18 as opposed to minus 19.5 for type 1As. If you look out here, where you can't even see these guys because of observational selection, you see, yes, there are some overbright, even brighter than 1As, some 1Cs and a 1B, but you don't really even have enough data to say whether, on average, 1Bs are brighter than 1Cs or not, not to mention trying to construct some kind of a luminosity function for these guys. So very limited what you can say so far. And then Dean also plotted not just at peak absolute magnitudes, but he collected light curves, everything he could find from the literature. None of this was observed by us. It's just from the literature or photometry people sent us. And this one is for 2Bs and 1Bs only. And this is what he could find. Now, again, there would be a few more that could be added by now. But absolute magnitude versus time, that's what the 2B, 1B sample looks like. And you see there's diversity, clearly. But how much can we say about it at this point? And for 1Cs, likewise, this is the data sample he was able to accumulate. Just that, even including hypernovae. No, not. He didn't include in this paper, that'll be next paper, bumps in afterglows. They're not on here. But 98BW is on here, 97EF is on here, O2AP is on here. That's what he's got. So, again, diversity, but we need much more data to be able to really probe what this distribution of light curves looks like. And I marked 94I here because it came up yesterday in Elena's talk. I like to make this point anyway, it wasn't just for yesterday, that 94I is our, we think of it as our prototypical ordinary 1C, and I do too, and I'm going to use it as that. But we should recognize that in the sample of light curves that we have, 94I is the most extreme in the sense of being fastest, up and down very quickly. The rise time was probably 10 or even maybe 9, 8 days. And then it decayed faster than any other type 1C that we have on here. So, well, Paolo said yesterday there is no such thing as a typical 1C, but we talk about it as if it is. But it's the fastest light curve. It's an extreme light curve. That's all I wanted to say about the photometry. We need more data. It's always safe to say that. Now let's go back to spectra. And this I... Now, a couple that I showed the other day, just to get us started. So the other day, the emphasis was on the 1A with the silicon 2 and the sulfur 2 lines. And then now we're going to go to the 1B. So here's an example of a 1B, a rather characteristic 1B. And the defining features of 1B are the strong, they must be conspicuous, unambiguous helium lines. That makes it a 1B. And 99DN has them, the three in green. And then I'm going to be particularly interested in this feature that has the question mark under it. And as long as we have it here, then we'll get to 1Cs. And you know, you see 94I is the one that shows up here. And I'm going to be particularly interested in that feature, which is so far from that feature. And then down here, although I'll say almost nothing, just a little bit at the end about hypernovae, because surely you're going to be hearing from Paolo Mazzoli about the spectra of hypernovae, not this week, but subsequently. But then from 94I, we make the leapfrog to the much broader and therefore more difficult to identify or interpret the features of the hypernovae, such as 98BW. So my question marks will also apply to this feature in 98BW as well. As I said, tried to emphasize on Wednesday, the Doppler broadening is in supernovae is awful, not only in type 1As, but in 1Bs, 1Cs, and especially hypernovae. It's dreadful. So we use synthetic spectrum codes, and I won't repeat all that I said on Wednesday, but I just have to remind you of a couple things. The simplest useful code, is the way I like to put it in self-defense, is the one I use called SINO. It's a parameterized resonance scattering code in which we have lots of free parameters. We're working from the data in an empirical spirit to try to extract constraints from the spectra. The other way around is to start with a model and calculate the spectrum of it and compare it to an observed. So I call this direct analysis, what I like to do. And then at the other extreme down here, there are the full NLTE codes. The one at Oklahoma is my colleague Eddie Barron uses it. I'm going to show just a little about that today. And then, Dan's stuff won't come up today. And then of intermediate complexity is the Paolo's Monte Carlo code. And I will only, I'll try not to say too much about that either. But I'll be doing most of what I show you today when I show you synthetic spectra, they're the SINO codes, where we just turn the knobs and try to fit the spectra. The main idea is to identify lines and maybe put some constraints on the velocity intervals in which the lines are forming, that sort of thing. So this one also the other day, very quickly, SINO, I told you it's a resonant scattering code. I want to emphasize again the very powerful thing we do know for supernova. If we didn't know this, we'd be lost. With the Doppler broadening, and if we didn't know the velocity law, what would we do? But we do know that we do expect that V proportional to R is a very nice approximation for supernovae. So that's something that we know. And that leads to some geometrical interpretation of line profiles that I'm not going to go into right now, but I'd be happy to talk about it with people. But it ends up giving you a resonant scattering feature where the photon is absorbed and re-emitted and by the same transition but in a different direction. That's all it is. A resonant scattering feature in this simple picture where we have a sharp photosphere and then a region of line formation surrounding it. It gives you a P-Cygni profile with an emission peak that's unshifted it's at the rest wavelength in the supernova frame, and the absorption feature will be blue shifted, and that's called a P-Cygni profile. So now something that we'll need to recognize before I start showing synthetic spectra, and that is what I mean by a detached line. Here I've used hydrogen as the example. These are both synthetic spectra from SINO. And so when I say undetached, what I mean is that the ion is undergoing line formation all the way down to the photosphere. In other words, from the photosphere on up. And if you have that situation where there's an optical depth at the photosphere and then it decreases exponentially, or power law in our code, as you go farther up, then you get the black kind of profiles. For H alpha, if I just set the optical depth of H alpha to be 10, it's the Sobolev optical depth. In the undetached case, you get the classical P-Cygni profile again. You get the emission peak at the rest wavelength and a blue-shifted absorption. And the blue-shift of the absorption depends on what the velocity at the photosphere is, of course. The bigger the velocity at the photosphere, then the more the absorption will be blue-shifted. Here I've used 10,000 kilometers per second for the velocity at the photosphere. H beta over here, similar, but its optical depth is weaker by a factor of 7, the Sobolev optical depth, than H alpha. So you can still see the H beta. You can even see the H gamma. Okay, but what I mean by detached, when I have a detached line, I mean that we have a photosphere, in this case up to 10, situated at 10,000 kilometers per second in the ejecta, and then the line formation of the hydrogen lines is not beginning at the photosphere. It's the optical depths in the hydrogen lines are non-zero, only beginning at 20,000 kilometers per second in this example. So we have a gap between the photosphere and the line-forming region for hydrogen. And here I've just taken hydrogen, I've said it's detached at 20,000 kilometers per second. So that's where the hydrogen optical depth turns on. Well, then you get the red kind of profiles. I've used a weaker optical depth, just tau equals 2. And H alpha then looks like this. Well, sure, if you allow the H alpha line formation only at higher velocities and think about it as just geometry, then this absorption component shifts to the blue. And it changes shape. It develops a sharp red edge, at least in the approximation that I'm using. But more to the point, perhaps, is notice the emission peak. Instead of being a rounded, peaked emission, it's a flat emission, which in the presence of blending with other lines can be very difficult to see. So one point here is that if you have hydrogen, or anything else for that matter, forming only at high velocity, you can look for its absorption features, but its emission features will not be conspicuous in a real observed spectrum. And so at a glance, you may look at it and say there's no hydrogen, but there may actually be hydrogen. And over here you see H beta doing a similar thing. You don't see the emission peak. This is easy to explain. I'm not going to do it right now, but it's easy. It's just a geometrical thing. You can't get away from it. If you have resonant scattering in a high-velocity shell, you don't get a peaked emission. You get a flat emission. And formally, it's flat.
Does it depend on the line of sight?
Well, this is all 1D, so line of sight doesn't matter. Yes. Sure. Everything I just said applies only, strictly speaking, applies only in spherical symmetry.
And you assume that this hydrogen keeps moving all the time at the same velocity?
Yes, every matter, the idea here is that the supernova hydrodynamics is over in no time before we ever even see it, and then every matter element coasts at constant velocity, and therefore, that's why I like to think of velocity as the radial coordinate, because it identifies a piece of matter, and that means that at any instant, V is proportional to R, and each matter element...
R is proportional to T.
Well, yes, R is VT, but then V is R over T. So at a given time, V goes as R, is the way I think of it. And every matter element has a velocity which does not change. I think that's what you wanted to clarify. Yeah. Right? Yes. Okay, now let's go to 1Bs and start with... let's see, it seems to me I may have... No, I didn't skip something. Okay, this is from a paper that I and many colleagues published in 2002. And it's to get us started with the typical 1B spectrum, 1999 DN, 17 days after maximum, considerably after maximum. And the black is the observed spectrum, which comes from Filipenko's group. And the red, as usual here, will be... a synthetic spectrum where we've turned the knobs and tried to fit the spectrum. And the velocity at the photosphere is 6,000 kilometers per second at this particular fit. Helium-1 lines, they're here. This one, this one, this one, even that one, which sometimes is too weak to see in 1Bs. They're detached at, this means they're detached at 8,000 kilometers per second. So where do we get V-fote? From the FE2 lines. To fit the FE2 lines, we have V-fote down at 6,000, and then we're allowing helium only to form up at, beginning at 8,000. And then a list of other ions that we have put in to try to account for the spectral features. So this, by my standards, is a quite satisfactory fit. There's no reason that SINO... There are many reasons why SINO should not produce perfect fits, because it makes some assumptions and approximations. And if you saw a perfect fit, you should be very suspicious. But, okay, that's a good fit. And so there's really nothing that needs explaining very much. You could say some of the line identifications might be wrong, but basically we're using uncontroversial ions, and so we think we know what the lines are. I put something this morning, I put something down here at the bottom. Thought we may as well make this point now. There's a in supernova spectroscopy, unlike stellar where the lines are so narrow, there's a classical ambiguity in line identifications. Helium-1, the strongest optical line is lambda 5876, but neutral sodium, the famous D lines, it's lambda 5892. It's just one line in supernovae. And they're only 800 kilometers per second apart. So if this line were weak, then we would have to worry, is it helium or is it sodium? And that is often the case. We don't really know if it's helium or sodium. If the line is strong, well then, if you see the other helium lines, then you know it's helium. If the line is strong and you don't see the other helium lines, well then you conclude it must be sodium. So in this case, we conclude safely it has to be helium. That's a classical identification ambiguity for supernovae, and I brought that up to introduce it now. Then we're going to come to another one shortly, maybe less classical. But did I hear someone wanting to ask a question? No. Now, here I'm just going to put in a plug for forthcoming work with the very complicated full non-LTE Phoenix code, which so far Eddie Barron has used primarily for type 1As and for type 2s. But he and some students, this student is an undergraduate student, they are now using Phoenix for type 1Bs and type 1Cs. And almost no work has been done on 1Bs and 1Cs at the, you know, the full non-LTE level where you really solve all the rate equations and do the radiative transfer as well as you can, and you don't make assumptions like a sharp photosphere, anything like that. So this, they're giving they gave this week an AAS poster, and I got this from them. This really impressed me. This is very, very recent. It's with the Phoenix code. It's the same spectrum as you just saw with a SINO fit. It's 99 DN. And they took a power law model. They didn't use a hydrodynamical model. They just took a power law model, I think R to the minus 8 or 7. And they used a uniform composition with some helium and some oxygen and so forth. And they get out this red spectrum, the Phoenix spectrum, and that, considering they don't have a bunch of free parameters like I do with Sino, I thought that was very encouraging. Now they need to explore some parameter space and see what needs to be done to fit it better. But they're getting the helium lines to come out, and they've got the oxygen. Okay, there's a problem with calcium. So I think that...
Can you use the abundances that you had from the Sino code?
No, actually in the Sino code we don't even specify abundances, because for each ion we have a free parameter that governs the strength of the lines of those ions. And I don't try to convert that into abundances, because if I did, people might believe them. And I don't want that. So, no, they just put in abundances. In this particular case, I actually have the details with me,
but
if you want to know.
Not, I mean, for the Phoenix code, yeah, they should be yielding abundance measurements, right? That's the goal.
Yes. Oh, yes, when you turn it around. But right now, they've said so much percent helium, so much percent oxygen, and the rest is solar metallicity, and just calculate. So they haven't gone backwards to try to figure out what's the best fitting abundance. They just guessed, well, educated guess, what composition, without any radial composition stratification either, yes?
I just don't know the numbers. So yeah, for these cases, what are your typical abundances that you expect or that you think you...
Well, one might say, first of all, if it's a type 1b, let's assume solar metallicity, because we don't know any better, and let's assume that all the hydrogen has burned to helium. So take the hydrogen, burn it to helium. So then you have a very helium-rich composition with solar metallicity. I'm pretty sure, I could check later, but for this particular fit, they have upped the oxygen abundance as well. They've taken some of the helium and, quote, burned it, unquote, into oxygen to get the oxygen abundance up. But they're not at the point where they're trying to give abundance results. The encouraging thing is just that they can take some sensible but simple model and actually get a fit like this, because with Phoenix, they don't have free parameters. Once they choose the structure of the model, they don't know what the spectrum is going to look like until they calculate it. So I just wanted to put in this plug. They're doing 1Bs now. They're doing 1Cs, although I don't have anything to show.
If it's helium burning material, is there some reason you don't see a nitrogen line?
Nitrogen is awfully difficult to see in the physical conditions of supernova photospheres. Yeah, it's hardly ever, if ever, identified, even though it may be present. In circumstellar, emission from circumstellar interaction, it's identified, but not in supernovae. It's very hard to see nitrogen. It's elusive. No, thank you for reminding me. Sure, this is full non-LTE with the rate equation solved. It's relativistic, although it doesn't matter for this phase. And non-thermal excitation is in here. They do some gamma ray deposition scheme, and so there is non-thermal excitation for the helium. Otherwise, they would never get it. Good point. I meant to say that, but I forgot. So I think it's very important that this work is underway, and maybe it'll become a little more clear later why I think so. So now let's address this question. High velocity hydrogen in type 1Bs, ? And this has been addressed in, well, at least these three papers. I think I'm a co-author on all three. Deng et al. Was done at Tokyo, Ken's group, and then the paper that I've already alluded to from 2002. And now there's a long paper by Elmhamdi et al. But I put 2006. It is now on AstroPH, and we all come to the same conclusions. Very, very similar conclusions. So the few transparencies I'm going to show you are actually from my paper in 2002. But I could show figures from other papers, especially the Elmhamdi has a bigger sample than I had. But the conclusions come out about the same. So the question is, do we have high-velocity hydrogen in type 1Bs? Remember, the defining characteristic of 1Bs is helium lines. But is there hydrogen also? And here, first of all, I want to say you have to look early, not 17 days after maximum, like where we're just looking. That's too late. Because once the Fe2 lines become strong, and as things cool, the Fe2 lines become all over the spectrum, then you really can't tell whether hydrogen is present, unless it's very strong. You can't tell if it's weak. All right, I'm going to... I put some of the basic conclusions right up front, and then we'll work through this quickly. I say definitely there's high velocity hydrogen in some type 1Bs. I'll try to show you that. I think probably in all or almost all type 1Bs. There may be exceptions. There is high velocity hydrogen. Although, watch out for aliases, and this is why it's not so easy to reach these conclusions. I talked about the helium sodium ambiguity, but H alpha, of course, is 65-63. Well, the strongest optical line of ionized carbon, which is a plausible ion to see in a supernova, is 65-80. It's only 700 kilometers per second to the red of H alpha. Now, I have a question mark here, but I think I'll just skip over it because it's a little ahead of myself. It has to do with why I don't think we're looking at C2-6580 in type 1Bs. Now, silicon 2-6355, well, that's the big, strong silicon line in type 1As. Silicon 2 is not an implausible ion to see, but its strongest optical line is not so far from H-alpha. It's 9,600 kilometers per second to the blue, shorter wavelength. But there's a problem with it. I won't talk about that right now. And then neon, neutral neon, that we don't talk about much, but I know that Paolo and Daniel are thinking about it now. Its strongest line is 6402. So it's 700 kilometers per second to the blue of H-alpha. And let me not bother to explain that statement right now. So we have these four ions that are not implausible to show up in a supernova spectrum, and every one of them has its strongest optical line in the neighborhood of H alpha. And so if the feature that you're looking at, the observed feature, is not strong, well, then you have to really worry which of the four, or some combination thereof, it might be. Yes?
But just to understand those velocities,
yes.
Is it 960 or the way you're
going? 9600.
9600.
Yeah, because yeah, this 6580, that's only 700 kilometers per second apart. This is 6355 as opposed to 65. So it's 9600 kilometers per second. So what it means is that, a little bit more about that. If you identify a line as silicon 2, 6355, I could say, well, it could be high velocity hydrogen detached 9600 kilometers per second faster, and therefore blue shifted over there. How do you know which it is? That's how the ambiguity comes in. And then a similar thing can be said for neon. Okay? Well, if you look at the legend at the top, it's going to give away what I mean by the question mark here. Here's 2000. This is from that 2002 paper. 2000H, a nice 1B. I made a mistake that I found this morning, so I crossed it out. The velocity at the black is OH, the red is SINO. Velocity at the photosphere is 8,000. That comes from fitting the FE2 lines. That's actually well determined within the context of the model, at least. Helium, again, is detached slightly. Instead of 8,000, it's only forming above 9,000. And here's the helium. Here's the helium. Here's the helium, although we'd like it to be higher. And then some other uncontroversial ions. So when we put in the ions that nobody would argue with, I believe, we get a decent accounting for most of the lines, except you're not supposed to see this. What's this? This is a sore thumb. And now we see that if we don't have this absorption in here, well, this absorption, if we had it, it would throw emission in here and it would move this up. So we need something to do this, and when it does that, it will help this. So what is it? And that's where this alias business comes in. But the answer is, I would bet serious money on this, the answer is that it's H-alpha. Because in this case, deep H-alpha 1B, it's so strong that if you try to make it one of those other ions, well, other lines of those ions are going to come in and cause havoc in the spectrum. So I believe this is H-alpha. And then, okay, the emission component, it's detached at 13,000 kilometers per second. And the emission component hasn't fixed this, but it's helped that it's raised this. And then, for support, when the H-alpha is this strong, you get H-beta in the synthetic spectrum, and there is a feature there that I think, is H-beta, as a matter of fact. And there are several 1Bs like this. I know of three. I call them deep H-alpha 1Bs.
Can you show the previous pick?
Sure. Sure. Which part did you want to see, the H-beta part? Yeah. See, what I did is I took the plot, of course, that had the H-beta on and the H-alpha, and I took it out, but I forgot to take the H-beta off. But, yeah, the H-beta isn't in the synthetic, but that's it. So when you see H-beta, you see a deep line, it has to be H-alpha in the first place, then you see H-beta show up, clinched. But this is a minority. This is the one we just looked at. I said there's only three 1Bs that I know of that have this deep, really deep H-alpha. And yet they're 1Bs.
And is it always detached in those three?
Yes, highly detached. I'm going to show you a summary slide of that shortly. Now, what if we go to a more typical 1B spectrum, and this is 1984L, 9 days after maximum. And you can see, I won't read you the parameters here. I guess you're getting used to this detachment business. The FE2 can be fit nicely, 8,000 kilometers per second. The helium lines are there. At this epoch, they're not so deep, but they're there. And then in this one, I'm not teasing you. I'm just putting in, I have the H-alpha in there, and I think it's H-alpha. I do not think it's carbon-2. I do not think it's silicon-2, and I could argue why. Although neon-1, the fourth possible thing, is difficult to exclude. So I think it's H-alpha, and I'm going to speak as if it's H-alpha. But neon-1 is not excluded. Now, neon-1, if you want to see neon-1, you may not need non-thermal excitation, I learned from Daniel the other day, but like helium-1, if you have non-thermal excitation due to the decay products of nickel, that will help make the neon lines stronger for the same reason it does helium. You get some excitation into levels that are hard to reach thermally. So that's why we need the really detailed that's one reason. We need the really detailed Phoenix calculations where they will be able to do the non-thermal excitation of the neon and tell us, is it plausible or is it really just can't be reached?
Well, the reason I'm asking, if you've got three of these and it's always detached, if you just ask the other question, does it always end up being naturally at the photosphere if it's neon?
That is an excellent question. And the answer is yes and no. It's tantalizing. I put that in one paper as a test. You know, in the future, we'll be able to just see. If you always can fit it with neon without detaching, well, then it's neon. Because why would the hydrogen always... The best answer is half the time it's consistent with neon, but half the time it's not. It's not clear yet. It's a really good test, I think. But if I take it literally, then I say, no, it's not neon, at least in half the cases.
But it's no worse than hydrogen.
I can always make hydrogen fit because I have a free parameter, how much I want to detach it. Yes. If I take neon, I don't want to detach it. I want to have it at the photosphere. Sometimes it fits, and in this case, it would do fine. I'll show you a case where it fits. Okay, maybe we should move on because I'll show you a case. But it doesn't always fit. That's the point. So that's why I have to say all or almost all, because sometimes it could be neon. And it takes detailed calculations to figure that out. It also takes in hydro model input as well. So here's the summary slide of that. Here's now we're plotting velocity, kilometers per second, against days after maximum for type 1Bs only. And this is the mean line drawn through the photospheric velocity inferred from the FE2 lines. Okay, so at maximum light, it's below 10,000 kilometers per second, and then it falls down like that. For the helium, these are the detachment velocities. And these down here. And so you see the helium, we consistently want to detach it somewhat from the iron. For the hydrogen, and this goes to one of your other questions, that's the open circles. These three guys, this one, and this one, are the deep H-alpha events. And so you can follow the hydrogen rather a long time after maximum light. And it's there, and it's up this high. And then for those that don't have deep H-alpha, you can only find it at early times. And if the identification is correct, then these are the detachment velocities, and they're high. And so your question actually could be framed this way. Are these always 7,000 kilometers per second above this? Because if they are, then that's a sign of neon. And they're not far off, but they're not always 7,000 kilometers per second above. Pardon? Yes, Daniel.
With the detachment velocity, is there a way to tell if it's a composition effect or ionization effect or I don't know?
One has to, to be honest, with Sino, I don't know. No. Because I just put it out there. Now, why? Is it composition discontinuity? Not discontinuity, but we treat it that way. Or is it ionization? Well, one way we do try to figure it out sometimes is you follow something with time, as time evolves, and if you see that detached feature shifting to the red, well, then you know it wasn't the composition discontinuity, it was an ionization gradient. But in general, if I just fit one spectrum, I have no way to answer that. So now, to finish with the 1Bs, this is my conclusion. All, or nearly all, type 1Bs have hydrogen. Neon is hard to exclude. At moment, I should say it's impossible to exclude in some cases. But if you accept all or even nearly all, then I have the question, why? Ken, Philip, Ed, somebody... Is it natural? Well, that's what I thought somebody might say. Of course. But is it in the literature? Is it? Okay, I'd like to know where...
You're always left with some
hydrogen. Always
the
left...
The question is...
How much?
You lose it... Initially, it's a tenth of a solar mass. The only question is, how much do you lose in the stellar wind afterwards?
Yes, okay.
And so, what
we want, based on crude estimates, what we want when it's weak here is a few percent of a solar mass in the high-velocity layer. And for the deep H-alphas, you probably need a tenth of a solar mass. So if it's natural, that's fine with me. I just haven't been able to find... And this is assuming it's mass transfer. Right. But these are binaries.
It will fade enough using hydrogen and just exposing the helium layer. I think it's rather strange. There is no pure helium atmosphere.
That's the question I was about to pose. It's the same question, but yeah, why don't we see some 1Bs with no hydrogen?
Yeah.
Good, strong helium, but no hydrogen.
There should be this.
And
massive ball from A star, the hydrogen is really gone. Yeah. The wind is so strong, so this, you don't expect helium.
These 1Bs that we've talked about here, they don't have broad light curves, so they're probably not very massive stars. I think binary transfer is more likely. Okay, let's keep going to get to 1Cs, where I hope to cause some trouble. Now, let's go. Now we're making a transition to 1C, and we start with this extraordinarily ordinary 94i that has an extreme light curve. And this is from a paper in 1990. I made another mistake. It's a good thing I got up early. This is Jennifer Miller did her senior thesis with me, so I'm responsible for this. This 94i, the phase, day minus 4 before maximum light, that's the black with the noise. And then the Sino fit that we published is the red. Notice VFOT is at this phase, two things. VFOT is quite high, 17,000 kilometers per second, comes from fitting this stuff. The spectrum is very blue. This is F nu. This is not tilted like I showed you the other day, where I just tilt the spectra. This is F nu. If I plotted F lambda, it would be more blue by a factor of lambda to the minus 2, right? We plot F nu so that we can at least see the red end of the spectrum. And yet, this feature we identified as sodium, even though sodium is a low-temperature ion, and the underlying spectral energy distribution is very blue. And the other thing is, we were then in the mindset of, which may turn out to be right, but we were in the mindset of bare carbon-oxygen cores for type 1C. Craig Wheeler isn't here, so I'll blame it on him. He insisted that they're bare oxygen cores. So this feature, this is the same kind of feature that I was talking about H-alpha before, we used a judicious blend of silicon-2 and carbon-2 to fit it. And to make it fit, we had to put a maximum velocity on the silicon of 20,000 kilometers per second. And then we let it go at that. Now, when I came back to 1BCs lately, because I had to say something here, I've been working mainly about 1As lately, This starts to look fishy to me. Both parts start to look fishy to me. And now I'm going to explain why. The more I look at it, the more it smells fishy. This is very boring, but it lead to something else. So we didn't fit just the -4 spectrum. We fit a lot of spectra. They came from various sources, so I won't name the sources of the spectra. Starting at 17, it was actually 17,500 kilometers per second, the fit we just saw, and then it comes screaming down the velocity at the photosphere and does that. Okay, so it comes down. But I showed you that so that then I could compare it to this plot you've already seen for the 1Bs, but now we put 94i on there. So if we put 94i, the velocity at the photosphere is a function of time. Well, that curve you just saw, I simply put it on here. It's this curve. So what we see, and I'm going to come back to this, is that at a given epoch with respect to maximum light, 94i has a higher vphot, and the lines are broader, and they're going to be more blue shifted, right? And it's especially different at early times, and then the difference diminishes as time proceeds. So what, you may say? Type 1BC. Now, I'm taking a step backwards to something that has been called type 1BC. Now, if I had to choose, I'd call it a type 1B. But it's 1999EX, which was not available when we did our 2002 paper, in spite of the fact this was 99EX. We et al. Published spectra and photometry of 99EX. And what they said is that at early times it looked to them like a 1C. But then, a little later, it looked more like a 1B. And I did some work a couple years ago fitting this spectrum, this and other spectra with CINAHL. I'll just show one. This isn't even a journal article. It's a conference proceeding, so I don't think it's very well known. That's 4 days after maximum. VPhot is 9,000. And hydrogen is in here. I don't think helium is detached in the synthetic spectrum in this case. Hydrogen is detached at 15,000, and you can find it. It's here. In this case, the line is strong enough, again, that I think it has to be H-alpha. It can't be any of the aliases, because they would do other bad things to the spectrum. I don't have H-beta to back it up in this. It's just too crowded over here. So you could doubt it, but I really think this is H-alpha. And nobody has argued with me with it, about it yet, at least. Detached at 15,000 kilometers per second, but that's interesting, because this guy early on looked like a 1C. I agree with them. But then it had hydrogen. But it's not an ordinary 1C, so interesting, but maybe it doesn't prove too much. Now, I introduced that because now I'm going to compare it with 94i, which is a 1C. And tilted just means I've tilted the spectra so that we can see both the blue end and the red end. So any information about blueness or redness of the continuum is gone. In black, 94i at maximum light, and we're interested especially in this feature. And in red, 99EX at maximum light. Again, for those who don't know, this is a terrestrial, atmospheric feature, molecular oxygen, and so is that. So don't worry about them, those sharp ones. I'll give you just a moment to see if you think there's some correspondence. If you start from the blue, you will see that there is some correspondence between those two spectra. And that's enough, because now you'll see what I want you to see, is if I take 99EX and simply blue shift the spectrum by 3,000 kilometers per second. Remember 94i, high VPhot. I want a blue shift. It's a free parameter for me. I just did it 1,000 kilometers per second at a time, and I got this. And now do you see any correspondence between those spectra? Again, this is calcium 2. Well, it shows up all supernovae, unless they're very hot. And this is mostly Fe2 stuff over in here. And then over in here, this is sodium in 94i, and this is helium in 99EX. This is correct. Question is that? This is carbon 2 and silicon 2 judiciously blended in 94i, and this is H alpha in 99EX, and I claim this is correct. And the question is that, are we all comfortable with these two interpretations?
There's a definite change in the profile of the lines.
Yes. Yes, this line is different shape than that, and so does this. Agreed? I'm not saying the top is wrong. I'm just trying to, I think we should reconsider 94i is what I'm saying, and I know you guys are reconsidering 94i also. So I, now, to beat this point a little bit harder, 4 days after, again, no blue shift for 99EX, you can find similarities. Yes, the helium lines are stronger in 99EX than they are in 94i, if they're in 94i at all, which is hard to prove. But now if I blue shift the 99EX, how are we doing for time? I want to get to one more thing after this. 2,000 kilometers per second instead of 3. Well, the same question. In many respects, the spectra are similar. This one has stronger helium lines, yes, that's why it's a 1B. This one does not, that's why it's a 1C. But in this region, is that sodium while this is helium, and is that that while this is that? And one more such example. If we go a little later in time, plus 10 days and plus 13, the nearest match I could get, unshifted, and then we'll shift them. By 1,000 kilometers per second now, they're converging. Well, this, that, that, that. Yeah, I agree the profiles aren't the same, but apart from this feature and the stronger helium lines, makes me worry. It starts to smell fishy. So I'm going to conclude this little part because I have something else to say. So the question was high velocity hydrogen in type Cs, and the question, not the solution, is the resemblance of the ordinary type 1C 94i to 99EX coincidental, or do ordinary 1As, that should not say 1A, that's 1C, have H alpha? I don't know the answer. I think we should worry about it. If so, suppose they do have H alpha. Well, then we could think perhaps like this. Perhaps ordinary type 1Cs like 94i that are not massive and they come from binary transfer with H alpha, and hypernovae, which are thought not to have H alpha, have distinct compositions, with only the hypernovae being the bare CO cores, and the 1Cs, the ordinary, more ordinary ones, being something different, having hydrogen in them. But that's not quite the end of the story, because now there is O5BF, and if I can talk about that in a few minutes, then I'll be finished. So, the bizarre, it's always bizarre until you see several more, and it just becomes a subtype, but so far this is bizarre. Bizarre type 1B slash C O5BF. There are three papers on it. The first two, Ken and Tommy, are co-authors. Well, in fact, Tommy is the first author of the second one. And the third one is, the first senior author is Mark Phillips. So it's the Las Campanas group and with other people. Three papers so far on O5BF. What's bizarre about it? Well, it's light curve. It's double peaked. Actually, let me describe it and then I'll just flash it at you. It's double peaked light curve with a primary maximum, the second peak was brighter than the first one, 40 days post-explosion. That's an extraordinary rise time for a 1BC. I'll bring this back in a moment, but here's the light curve, which I lifted from Folatelli et al. They're on AstroPH. I don't know if it's published yet. And they tried to construct a bolometric light curve, and all we have to do is look at the data points and see that this is what we mean by a double peak. But 40 days to go from estimated explosion date up to peak. That implies a lot of mass, right? Then, what else about it? Initially, its spectrum looked like a 1C. That's why some people at least call it 1B/C. And then it turned to a type 1B, reminiscent of 99EX, of course, but the light curve's very different. And from all three papers agree, the three papers, I think this is true, correct me if I'm wrong, all three papers conclude there's hydrogen. The first paper used the Sinow code. The second paper used Paolo's code. I assume Paolo used Paolo's code. You must be on that paper, too. I forgot to mention that. And the third paper, to my surprise, Mark Phillips decided to learn how to use Sinow. And he came to this conclusion that there's high velocity, 15,000 kilometers per second, calcium-2, Fe2, and H-alpha at early times. And here, this is very interesting because you've seen me invoke H-alpha out around 15,000, but he says he sees high-velocity calcium-2 and iron-2 at the same velocity. So that supports the H-alpha identification. If you have, you know, you've got something out there at 15,000, well, then the H-alpha seems pretty secure, although I want to check that for myself. By the way, this is a good time for me to mention that the Sinow code is, we make it available to anybody who wants to use it, and it's not, doesn't take long to learn how to use it if you'd like to, would like to play around. At the very least, it's a nice pedagogical tool for students because you can learn to use it pretty quickly and you can use it interactively. It runs so fast. Okay, so now I'm summarizing what's been said in these three papers. It's much more has been said, but the idea is that there's a, maybe I'm summarizing from the second and third papers. A two-component explosion is what you guys have in mind, I believe. There's a low-mass polar ejection, bipolar presumably, and that caused the first dimmer peak in the light curve, and it came at high velocity polar ejection, and that's the high velocity features that Phillips is identifying. And then the massive main explosion caused the second peak, the rise time to 40 days, and the lower velocity features that I haven't shown you yet, but I'm about to. So the idea is, well, if you have a 40-day rise time, you surely need a massive progenitor because you have to even eject quite a bit of mass. And if you have some polar ejection going on, well, then that just reminds me to read the title of the Folatelli et al. Paper, the most recent one, 2005 VF, a transition event between type 1bc supernovae and gamma ray bursts. Now, I didn't see a gamma ray burst, not that I'm aware of, but massive progenitor and indications of some high velocity, not relativistic, but high velocity bipolar ejection. So they call it a transition event. So I got a spectrum. I got more this week, I see, in the mail, but I haven't been able to do anything with them. But I got a spectrum from Filipenko's group. This has not been published, and they're happy to have me play Sinow on it. So it was a nice, very nice spectrum of O5BF at maximum light. Now, the other groups have spectra at maximum light too, so it's not brand new, but it's just what I've been working with. So if I take, and the red is Sinow, and if I just take the usual suspects and fit the spectrum as best I can, I get, by my standards, the fit is fine. Except, again, there's something missing in the question.
What is it that's missing?
This is not for volume for you. It's that all talks must be recorded for posterity. Or for something. So, I just mentioned hypernovae, and maybe we should think about silicon too right off the bat. Well, if I just put in silicon 2, undetached, I can't put it any lower than that. Undetached, just starting at the photosphere, the silicon 2 looks like that. Vertical mismatches I don't worry about too much. Why should Sinow get it right? But horizontal mismatches bother me a lot, wavelength mismatches. That means, unacceptable. I don't think it's silicon 2. So what about the neon? Well, if I don't detach it and fit it like that, and it's weak enough that the other neon lines, they're creeping into the spectrum, but one can't complain about them. So it's not excluded by me, anyway. And whether that requires non-thermal excitation or not, I don't know. But we know there's non-thermal excitation because there's helium lines here. And then what if you just take the H-alpha forming, detached at 15,000 kilometers per second? Well, I see what everybody's saying is you can, if you detach it, you can get the dip at the right place. Yeah, but you don't get the right-hand side of the line from just having hydrogen above 15,000 kilometers per second. This actually surprised me. And by the way, I'm very nearly finished. So if I put in a hydrogen optical depth profile that has its peak at 15,000 kilometers per second, in other words, hydrogen is the biggest optical depth is at 15,000, but it doesn't go to zero below that. It's continuous, rising from the photosphere at, I don't have the velocity on here, whatever the photospheric velocity is, rises, peaks at 15,000, and then comes back down again. Yes, I can fit this just as well as I can fit it with neon, but of course I have free parameters here. So the other groups say it's H-alpha, and I'm not disputing that it's H-alpha, but I worry that it could be neon. I'm not sure. But if it's hydrogen, if the whole feature is hydrogen, then my point here is you don't only need hydrogen out at high velocities in this case, you need some hydrogen all the way down to the photosphere. Okay, now we go to hypernovae. The hypernova, the editorial, the interpretation of hypernova spectra started here in 1997 at a workshop because you were here and you were here, I was here, and we saw these new spectra of 97 EF, and we thought they were really bizarre, and that's where it started. And what we have done, and I think when I say we, probably I mean Paolo and me bear the responsibility for this, right or wrong. What we have done, what we did back then is we said, look, it's a 1C. So you take 94i, where you can actually see some lines, and you just say, well, we've got to smear it all out by high velocity and Doppler broadening. So we started with the mindset of bare carbon oxygen cores that we had at that time. And so we had silicon 2, carbon 2 if necessary. So my one and only paper on hypernova spectra, and it's again, it's only a conference proceedings, I just want to show that, yeah, I was using silicon 2. You'll recognize, you know, calcium 2, oxygen 1. At this epoch, which I didn't write down, they're not totally blended together, and I was using silicon 2. And Paolo, just as guilty. This is from a 97 EF paper, and the synthetic is the narrow line, and here it says silicon 2. This is a silicon 2 feature, and that's what we all think it is, or that's what we're supposed to think, that it's silicon 2. And well, you see my point. I don't know if it's silicon 2. So, last one. Hydrogen even in hypernovae, which I thought would at the very least be provocative. Here's the reasoning for the question. Even O5BF, the bizarre guy, which was classified as type 1C at early times and appears to have been related to hypernovae. Now, it wasn't a hypernova spectrum with really broad lines. We saw that. But there were those other respects in which one might suspect it's related to hypernovae, massive progenitor and bipolar ejection. That one, I'm assuming here, had hydrogen. If it didn't have hydrogen, then it had neon. It wasn't silicon too. And so the question is, do all type 1 Cs, even hypernovae, have hydrogen in their spectrum, and I added this morning, and then, of course, what would that mean? And then the other question for the spectroscopists is, how solid is the silicon 2 interpretation, not only in ordinary 1Cs, but in hypernovae? And on this issue, the big issue, what would that mean for progenitors and so forth? And please address your questions to each other. Thank you. I'm finished.
But didn't you cast some doubt on the interpretation of hydrogen in O5PF?
I did on part of it and not on the other, and it flashed through my mind at the time that I wasn't being complete, so let's go back just a little bit. Okay, I said that at maximum light, I was trying to get so many things in at once that I didn't say all that I should have said. This is at maximum light, and if you don't want to believe the hydrogen, you might like to believe the neon. So that was the doubt about it. And then I said that if it is hydrogen, it's not only up at 15,000, you have to have it going lower.
Right. So you have implying some fine-tuning.
Yeah. Yes.
But you don't have to do
but right, yes. But the Phillips identification, and I'm sorry, at the moment I really don't remember the details of the other two papers, what epochs you studied, but the Phillips identification of H alpha was at earlier times, at the first peak. And there, although I just obtained the spectra, I haven't studied them independently, but let's assume he knows what, he's got it right. There, he says, we see calcium 2 up at 15,000 kilometers per second. We see Fe2 up at 15,000 kilometers per second. And that number, so it's not now a free parameter, the H alpha fits. So I think the H alpha at 15,000, I'm assuming it's correct. That's why I say it had hydrogen. Now, whether it has hydrogen down at this lower velocity, what I forgot to put on here, at the second maximum, it's debatable. I still think O5BF had some hydrogen. Yeah.
It had it all the time. In the very earliest spectrum, it was misclassified. It was never at once.
Because it had a weak
hydrogen was always
a weak H alpha.
Yes.
Yeah, well, is 94I1C. Because it has a feature that could be weak H alpha. That's where the problem is.
94I is an interesting one, right?
Well, other 1Cs.
The hypernova is what I would not be so convinced, because the silicon comes out quite naturally, because of course the velocities are high, so you don't have to invoke the velocity of silicon to learn the stellar velocity.
That's a good positive point.
So you just put it there, it comes out. If you want to use neon, you never know what non-thermal processes will do to you. Mm-hmm. So you don't even have to wait to solve. But if you just put it in as it is,
yes.
You don't get it.
Okay.
And you need a hell of a lot of neon, and even then you don't get a lot of things.
Thermally. Yeah.
That's expected anyway. So, so silicon is there, you use a reasonable amount of it, you get a line that looks right, you kind of say it's right. I mean, having done this
okay.
Balance
stuff and so on. Okay. I understand. In the typical ones, the silicon 2 is hard to believe, but hypernovae?
I mean, I have more that I've looked at where I see hydrogen above 10,000, 12,000, but not hypernovae. Hydrogen is always there.
In 1Cs? Okay.
But they don't call them 1Cs anymore, because what are they?
It's a thing. Yeah.
But they also tend to have some helium. So
yeah, I think so too. I didn't try to argue that, but I think so.
The real 1Cs that you still call 1Cs because you don't see helium, with perhaps the exception of
I don't know, but I've looked at others.
I still would not. Right, I haven't done it yet.
That feature in 94i, it does appear in other ordinary 1Cs. Sure, but, well, tau of V determines what it's... But can I go back to the hypernovae? You say the silicon 2 is natural. that is assuming what model? Is it really a hydrodynamical model with the silicon 2 calculated nucleosynthetically?
Yeah, taking like Ken's explosion models.
Just take a CO60 model or something.
Ship abundances,
you don't have to fiddle with it to make the silicon 2.
Actually, the sulfur lines there as well. You don't see it, it's blended. Are sulfur lines that show. I mean, they don't show up. They're there. You make your spectrum.
They have optical depths. Yeah.
They blend, so you don't see them individually. But the sulfur is there, as is the silicon with silicon. Only for 94i, and I've been agonizing over it. There's ambiguity in the amplification. There's velocity problems, because other lines that creep up, because temperatures are. The hypernova temperatures are almost at the 180. And so, I would argue that it's quite a few of these problems just.
Now, about progenitors, I always used to think that the progenitors of 1Ds, because of the helium and the absence of hydrogen, those were Wolf-Rayet stars. But Wolf-Rayet are only the very massive helium stars, above, say, 5 or 6 solar masses, then they turn out to show a Wolf-Rayet spectrum, and they would certainly blow away all the hydrogen during their evolution.
Yeah.
So that when they collapse, you would not see hydrogen.
It's never a very large mass. I mean, we would be getting that at 0.1, 0.05, 0.03. I mean, so.
Okay. So those are lower mass helium stars, and those you make in binaries.
Binaries.
Then you would keep the hydrogen. Indeed, you would always have a little bit of hydrogen left because they have not a strong nucleus. That is what you were saying.
Yeah. Okay. Well, if there is a place in the literature that where I could find, you know, clearly stated that the, you'll always leave some hydrogen.
But after the mass
sensor,
you always leave some hydrogen.
Yeah, a little bit.
A few percent of a solar mass.
Depends on the mass. Yeah. It can be a few tenths of a solar mass.
So okay, but at least a few percent is what I wanted.
Yeah. Well, the Wolf-Rayet. Helium stars above 5 or 6 solar masses.
That so would be from the spectra. Would you be able to tell us?
No. Well, you would not expect hydrogen unless there is hydrogen from the link of the companion, but that is probably very little, I think. But there are Wolf-Rayet the WNs, like you see in the Magellanic clouds, which still have hydrogen there. And those are very massive single stars, probably. In the course of their evolution, they blow away a lot of their outer layers, but they still have
so
hydrogen.
These would be your massive 1Bs.
They would be very massive, I think.
But you don't know whether they still have hydrogen left at the time of the explosion.
You don't know.
Relatively young objects.
Yeah.
Well,
you
but,
don't know. But you don't know whether they really would evolve to ones, the WCs. I don't know. I mean, nobody really knows whether these stars couldn't explode and they're still a WM.
But one thing that is missing is an estimate of the mass and energy of the 1Bs. But I don't think that's anything.
People have fitted spectra of like atmospheric spectra, this thing of Wolf-Rayet, WNs and WCs, just like you were saying. In the WCs, I don't think you see any hydrogen, but they have WNs, which are like almost, I was just recently looking at this because I was trying to use it for something else. There are some which are like 20% hydrogen, what they claim.
What about when they don't see it? What's the what kind of upper limit on the hydrogen content do they have? Are they really devoid of hydrogen?
Oh, I mean, they should be, because some of them...
They should be, yeah. They should be, yeah.
But the WC, some of them will just lose the entire outer envelope. So there is nothing, no hydrogen left at all. But there's different classes, and some of them... I mean, like, there's very few that people have actually fitted atmospheric spectra carefully. But if you look at the literature, I was just trying to find this a few months ago, and there are some where they claim that there's a certain amount of hydrogen, especially.
But there's no possibility that rotational mixing, right, keeps some hydrogen in even the barest?
Big massive stars, I don't expect much rotational mixing.
Okay. So what I put this back because I think what I'm hearing from most of the discussion is, remember this one, before we went to hypernovae, then I was posing this question. If so, if the ordinary ones have hydrogen, then maybe there are two distinct 1Cs. The ordinary ones, they have some H-alpha, they come from relatively low mass, massive stars. It's binary mass transfer, you don't get rid of all the hydrogen. And your point of view, I think at the moment at least, is hypernovae, you don't think they have H-alpha, you're happy with the silicon. And so they have distinct compositions from from Wolf-Rayet stars.
So can I ask, when you say binary low mass, what kind of mass?
are you talking about? There's light ray, there's some mass transfer, there's some hydrogen.
2.5 solar mass, helium stars.
What's the initial mass?
Your main sequence mass. 12, 10.
12.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And the initial mass goes down all the way to 8.
Down to 8, yeah.
Okay, so you're saying that they don't have to be anywhere close to like 2025 at all.
They could be 2025 as well.
So then,
there's nothing wrong with that.
They should by far dominate the sample. And
they will dominate the sample.
Just not there at all.
But you're dominated by the lower mass.
Yeah, so you dominate the lower mass, but the upper limit is going to be you need to prevent it from.
That's what I'm getting at.
You don't want to let it lose the type.
That's what I'm getting at. So what is the limit that you're.
Well, but we don't know mass loss. You know, that if you want an exact number, you have to say you know mass loss.
Well, I mean.
But 2025 would probably be a good.
Yeah, but that takes you to the hyper range at that point. If you're moving above 25, I'd say we've not seen a single one that isn't very massive. And
if you have a 5 solar mass helium star with half a solar mass of hydrogen on top of it, what's the mass loss rate? I don't know.
But doesn't that look like already like a volcanism if it's 5 solar mass? It's at the lower
what,
end
what
of the
what is it in sequence X3? The mass loss rate is quite low, isn't it?
10 to minus 6.
It's 10 to minus 6 solar mass to be there, and that's...
No, it's a whole star.
For what?
The companion of sequence X3, which is a Borfrey star. Yeah. So that's a fairly massive object. It has a mass loss rate of 10 to minus 6 solar masses per year.
You don't see hydrogen there. It's helium. No, it's
characterized by the helium lines in the infrared. So, if you have 5 solar masses of hydrogen, it would be a type 2.
No, 5 solar masses of helium.
The 5 of helium. Why 5 of hydrogen?
No, helium. Yeah.
That's what it's
just that style with a 20 solar mass. Yeah.
So, in this interpretation, the ordinary one C should have some helium, but not excited.
Yeah.
Hydrogen, presence of hydrogen bright, presence of helium.
Yeah. My feeling is they do have helium, but I did not try to argue that today. It's a harder argument to make. But I suspect they do. Hmm?
There is no mixing between nickel and this.
Maybe not between nickel and helium. Yeah. Maybe the helium is buffered.
And hyperonic, mostly, we expect lots of nickel near the surface, the jets or mixing.
So if.
That excludes the helium there.
The
helium there.
Not inside the helium.
But is it clear that the helium is not there in hypernovae? We've got a feature identified as sodium, could be 5876, and in 98 BW for sodium. I thought we had it early on. Well, okay. Okay. Yeah, this is December 24th, so I guess it's fairly late. You have sodium, but fairly late. But then, wasn't helium identified in 98 BW, the 10830? Oh, you don't believe it.
What is
I just it's in the literature.
All that paper, but I have no response to the isn't.
Okay.
What is the hypernova rate compared to the normal 1BC rate?
Who? That's
one
cool.
In a thousand.
That's right.
I can show you.
In terms of corpulence, it's 1 in 1,000 corpulence.
That's the gamma ray burst, but.
No, that's the hypernova rate too.
5%.
It's 5% of the 1B1C rate.
What? 5%. Okay.
Of the 1D1C, yeah.
That's very little.
Are you showing infrared spectrum of BW? It's probably on my.
I'm sorry?
Are you showing infrared spectrum of BW versus of type 1B? And there's the 10830 putative helium feature in BW. And the 20, the 2 micromine, not there.
I don't want the camera to
the same 10830.
All right.
For me, that's fine.
Okay. But, yeah. The 10830 can be something else. There's aliases for that.
Someday, someone will ask the question.
And that's fine.
5BF is not
flux prosthograph.
No. We don't see.
In our models, Nicker and here, nothing.
I'll show you one that has a slightly larger energy, and even there you see hydrogen and hydrogen is comparable. Still not a high nova, but it's getting.
So somewhere you want to make it a transition from O5BF and this other guy have hydrogen, not silicon, and then separately the true hypernovae, where you want it to be silicon. No argument against it. It's just that what strikes me still fishy is that we started with the interpretation of 94i as a bare core, and that line was silicon, and now we're saying, no, maybe it wasn't. But it still is in the hypernovae. Could be.
We don't have the problems there. All those lines come out just physically. Just put the evidence there.
Yeah. Unless they have numbers of
condition. Yeah, so that's what this happens. You might say, well, I don't want silicon, but then you take the silicon out of the mixture. Then you replace it with hydrogen. But as long as there's some silicon in there, you get that line. So why go for something?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just so as not to give up too easily. There's this big peak here at H alpha. You can't get that from H alpha if it's only detached, by the way. Remember, you get a flat. You'd have to have hydrogen all the way down the photosphere. They have a hell of a lot of mixing.
And it's too much emission for the absorption.
Nah, but H alpha, we know from type 2s, it's not resonance scattering.
Yes.
It's in net emission.
Yeah,
generally in net emission.
From
yeah.
Okay, it's the question if the present of GRD is completely BSU stuff, or helium stuff can make it work. It depends on this interpretation. If hydrogen can exist in hypernovae feature, or only in ordinary type C has some hydrogen,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Then
yeah.
Study suggested the only bare CO star can make hypernovae or GRDs.
Mm-hmm.
But theoretically, I don't know. With helium layer, still can just make through the surface. So. BF, I think in our interpretation there is a jet, but doesn't reach the failed jet.
Failed, yeah. So it could be that it failed because there is hydrogen out there.
And no, just weak energy.
Just too weak in the first place at launch.
I
does that mean the star did not rotate fast enough to make it?
Probably, or neutron star, or black hole issue. Remnant maybe neutron star rather than black hole.
I mean, probably the EF is like the spectral themselves, I'm not sure.
With EF?
BF
is the light curve.
It's a light curve. If you only have looked at the spectrum, it would be so hard. Leaning towards sort of type 1B with some
idea. I would say if you look at the maximum light spectra, it would not be remarkable.
Exactly.
But if you look at the very early spectra, you've got, if Phillips is right, you've got this velocity, high velocity stuff out at 15,000 kilometers per second. Do we? 1 BC?
Well, you see the hydrogen.
Assuming we see the hydrogen, yeah.